Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and before getting to my guest, who is certainly, as advertised, unafraid to speak the truth, I have some ginger flashes for you, those remarkable pieces of scientific news that cross my wife's desk, really her, I guess, her computer, and that she keeps me up to date on every week. A few interesting things. First, as we discussed earlier, the evidence is really out there now that the disability rates in children for psychiatric reasons have been skyrocketing over the last 10 years. They're up over 60% for things, for the following three things, actually. All three are over 60%. Speech problems, mental retardation or intellectual impairment, and other mental, emotional, or behavioral problems. This 10-year period also has seen a huge increase in providing, quote, services to the, quote, mentally ill child, resulting in a vast increase in disability. Meanwhile, there's been a slight decrease, in physical disability. It's mental disability that's skyrocketing. I believe it's a combination of drugging our kids and what goes along with it. Some of those things we may discuss today, such as parents and children giving up responsibility for their kids and the children being taught they can't control themselves, that they have a mental disorder and need drugs. A 60% increase in this decade over, in terms of psychiatric disability for children at a time when physical disability rates are going down. Now, you might think, well, this is going to be a lot of poverty-ridden children, parents who are getting needed help for their kids. Well, that's not at all what it is. Parents with children in income levels 400% above the federal poverty level, 400% above it, had the highest rate of disability compared with children living below the poverty level. And this, I think, tells you that it's actually the availability of psychiatric services, of, quote, sophisticated parents who believe in psychiatry and take their children to psychologists and psychotherapists and pediatricians for treatment, that their kids are getting more intensely disabled at higher rates by psychiatry. Going along with this general theme, yet another meta-analysis of the efficacy of an antidepressant, in this case comparing paroxetine, that's Paxil, and placebo, using all of the drug company-sponsored studies put up on GlaxoSmithKline's website. See, the law is required, and they're finally fulfilling this years later, that the drug companies get all their clinical trials up onto the websites that they've sponsored, and the results continue to confirm that you can't really show that antidepressants are helpful. The same results that have been gotten for the depression in the past, that there's probably no clinically significant difference at all. In the previous studies, it was perhaps very severely, there might be some difference, but nothing to risk giving the drugs for. And they didn't do well this time looking at their use for anxiety either. So what are we left with? It's very hard to show, almost impossible, even with drug company studies, that these drugs are helpful. And drug company studies are they're coached, you know, they're coached by the drug company, they're written by the drug company, the docs are picked by the drug company and paid by the drug company, and then these so-called these so-called independent researchers, then send the data into the drug companies. The drug companies evaluate the data, not the so-called researchers in the field. And finally, the drug companies often write the papers. So even with that, they can't show efficacy. When they look at all the trials, their own sponsored trials, you can't show efficacy for Paxil. And I can tell you, these guys at GlaxoSmithKline, I've looked inside their hearts, that is right into their statistics, into their data, into their files, been in their house, literally, as an expert in product liability. And I can tell you, they just hide data. I've written some about this. You can go to my website and look up my studies on how GlaxoSmithKline has distorted its data. Now, I've often said, and it's never been contested, that we have no studies showing that typical psychiatric hospitalization helps people, yet we actually do it involuntarily. There's no evidence. There's no studies. I don't know of any. I'm still waiting for the study to show that psychiatric hospitalization, let alone involuntary hospitalization, helps people. But now we have a meta-analysis of studies out of Germany where there is a unique phenomena called psychotherapeutic hospital treatment in Germany. Oh, by the way, if you want to get the Paxil study, it's PLOS1. You can Google it, I'm sure. The first author is Michael Sugarman, The Efficacy of Paroxetine and Placebo. I'm sure you can find it on PLOS1 or Googling it. Second study is also PLOS1. I wonder when the drug companies are going to try to shut these people down if they haven't already. And that one shows that this study shows that psychotherapeutic hospital treatment, you go into a hospital, instead of getting drugged, you get caring attention. They reviewed 67 papers, and they come to the conclusion that there's good evidence that the treatment does help people. So I'm not surprised that going into a protected setting where people talk to you instead of drugging you is going to help people. There's no big surprise there. Anybody surprised? Wave your hands in my audience. Anybody surprised? I don't think my guest, Jeannie Stolzer, is surprised. Are you there, Jeannie?
I'm here.
Hi. You listening to my rousing ginger snaps?
Loved it.
all right. Jeannie Stolzer, well, she's a really interesting person, and I've had her on before, and after I introduce her, she's going to tell you about how you can come hear me speak, because she invited me to speak at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, and it's only a few weeks away. My goodness gracious. Jeannie's professor of child and adolescent development at the University of Nebraska, Kearney. She's done a ton of research. She calls it compendious research. And she's published a course and researched across five continents. She's presented a lot of papers, and she's gotten a lot of different research awards. And she's been the passionate child advocate, and that really is true, for over 30 years. Her research interests include the risks associated with psychiatric drugs, ADHD, attachment parenting, the negative effects of psychiatric labels, nature deprivation. I'm not sure if that's a misprint, nature deprivation, childhood deprivation, I think she's going to talk about, breastfeeding, co-sleeping. She's an advocate of, really intense parent-child relationships. And that gets controversial, and that's something that I'm going to be really interested in talking with her again. And despite her courage and all these things she talks about, she's now got tenure. She's an associate professor.
Full professor.
You're full. Actually, you know, my mind bled. Does that? I get these little dings. And I was thinking about another very powerful woman professor who just got an associate professorship despite holding very strong views. Times are changing. Of course, you're a full professor, and I know that. I was just corresponding with another friend about that. So where do we go? Where do you want to begin today?
Well, first I want to talk about you coming to my university, which is I can't tell you how excited I am. It's on September 15th, 7 p.m., the University of Nebraska, Kearney. And we're right on Interstate 80. And we do have an airport so you can get here. And your talk is entitled Biological Psychiatry versus Empathy and Human Connection, How Psychiatric Drugs Do More Harm Than Good. And in all the years I've been, you know, doing what I do, and you've always been my mentor from afar. And to have you at this university is unbelievable to me. And I want to tell your listeners that you're really going to be there live.
Wow. That is so nice. That's cool. That's the word cool is appropriate to everything you just said. Thank you, Jeannie. Folks, you know, go travel. And, you know, I'm going to talk for an hour and a half or so or whatever, and then I'll probably take questions until I get really tired. So it'll be a while. It'll be a lot of interaction. What's the nearest big city? Kearney, you call it. It's spelled K-E-A-R-N-E-Y.
That's right, and it's pronounced Kearney. Don't ask me why. I have no idea.
Well, that really will fool a radio audience. What's the next biggest city? It's free, too, right?
It's absolutely free, and I wrote the grants. You can come. It's free. Unbelievable that Dr. Peter Bragan is going to be speaking, and it's free.
What's the nearest big city?
Lincoln and Omaha, Nebraska. Yep.
Well, I hope in a couple of weeks that somebody, just one person, will come up to me and say, Peter, I listened to your radio show, and I heard about this at the last minute, and I came. Do me a favor. Somebody do that. In fact, if you just know somebody in Nebraska or the surrounding states, give them a call. Tell them Peter Bragan's going to be there. He wants to know that one person came from his radio show. Maybe more.
Yeah, we need more.
But I really do appreciate your inviting me. I'm waiting for the second, third, fourth, and fifth shoes to drop on your head as a result of inviting me.
I spoke with the dean yesterday, and I had told him that it is possible that, you know, because we're associated with a medical center here that gets probably 98% of their funding from the pharmaceutical industry, that you could be disinvited. That could still happen. It's not going to happen because I've got here's the secret weaponry. I've got the dean, the vice chancellor, and the associate vice chancellor all funding this, so they're all behind me.
Heck, you know what you could do? Overnight me the check, and what can they do?
I think that's right.
We'll hold it out in the open on the street.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I'm very excited about coming, and I'm very excited about spending time with you and meeting your dean. And just savoring the changes that are taking place out there. There are big changes, including this research coming out of PLOS 1, you know?
It's amazing, isn't it? We've known it for years.
What's that, Jean?
We've known it for years that, you know, they're no more effective than placebos. But for some reason, it's been hidden from the consumer.
Now, what these articles don't emphasize is that while we can't show any good effect, we sure can show tons of harm. I am sure that every single one of their studies has multiple reports of adverse effects, including agitation, anxiety, suicidal feeling, worsening depression. Some of it will be weeded out and hidden and distorted, as I described in my publications about Paxil and GlaxoSmithKline, but some of it is going to filter right on through. So, again, I think it bears repeating. Psychiatric drugs, hard to prove they help, easy to prove they harm. It should be repeated again and again.
And again and again and again and again.
And the mic again goes back to you, and I'm now just going to say, you know, talk about something on your mind.
Well, as you know, my research streams, I have two different ones. I do attachment parenting, and that was right. Nature deprivation is one of my research interests.
Okay, I gotcha. Yeah.
instead of loading the kids up, you know, with Ritalin, we've got to take them to the forest. We're deprived of our bioevolutionary heritage. We are mammals at our core. And when you take any mammal, it doesn't matter if it's a German Shepherd or a lion or a human, and you deprive them of the place, the smells, the soil, the sunlight that they evolved in, there's going to be unbelievable problems. And that's part of the reason we're seeing such high rates of the drugging of our children. They're deprived. They're deprived with attachment processes. They're deprived with nature. It's incredible to me that we're living in these times.
I think that's so true, Jean. When I was a young boy, I think as young as 10, I think I ran away from home and went to nature. I'd just leave. They didn't call the police. They were just glad I was gone. And I would go and I would walk through the woods and along the creeks. I lived on Long Island, you know, one of these newly Jewish communities out there that were moving out from Brooklyn and New York City and the Bronx and so on. And I would go for walks in nature. I would go and try to grab little fish or at least look at little fish in the creek and watch birds and be by myself. And I still take huge comfort. I've always taken huge comfort in nature. And I was watching a show about inner city kids the other day, and there was a statement about one of their projects that helped the kids, and the commentator said, at least the kids get to see a little green this day.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. And when you couple that with attachment deprivation, you have, and the rise of the pharmaceutical industry, of course, and the psychiatric state, you've just got a recipe for disaster, and we're living through that disaster right now.
I want to talk to you more about this nature because, you know, this is something you've thought so much more about than me, obviously, and I think my listeners could benefit from this because I'm very fond of saying that to just give me a lake to stand by and I feel in the presence of nature and God, and this is really important. So to talk some more about this whole issue that you've been studying about nature and good spiritual, physical, mental health.
Well, it's been our bedrock for millions of years, and we are systematically depriving our children of every essence of the natural world. If you really think about schools, it's an odd thing to think about, but they're brand new in terms of humanity. For 99.999% of our time on Earth, our children learned everything they needed to know with their mothers and in nature. I mean, that's what it was. And now we're taking six-week-old babies and we're putting them in full-time daycare. And they're sitting on lines by the time they're 12 months old, and they're standing in lines by the time they're 15 months old. It's bioevolutionarily at odds with our nature. And we're seeing the effects of that.
As far as we know, I mean, the group I know the most about that's more primitive is, you know, I've read a fair amount about Native Americans. And the women would take their children on their backs or by whatever other method out with them into nature when they were going out there gathering.
Yes,
is that a pattern? Do we know about that? Would they take their 5 and 6 and 7 year olds with them?
Absolutely, and it's not just Native Americans. It's across all cultures, and I really get condemned for some of my research because they call me anti-woman, anti-feminist. When I start talking about, for 99% of our time on Earth, mothers, you know, they weren't drugged during birth. They breastfed constantly. They co-slept. They remained in close physical proximity with their young. And those mothers worked. There's never been a time when women did not work. Of course they worked. Like you talked about gathering, they were doing this and this. But they had to mother simultaneously. And that's what they did across every culture. And now we've sort of dichotomized the public and private spheres. And mothers cannot take their children to work with them. We've absolutely forbidden it. And so we're in this maelstrom that we're in right now. And I know that's politically explosive, and I know it's controversial, and that's my work.
I think it's amazing work. And just as an aside, you know, I haven't been talking about my new book, which comes out December 4th, but which can be purchased in advance on Amazon.com. And it's called Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. But the first third of the book is an evolutionary theory about how we develop guilt, shame, and anxiety as a means of controlling our violence in our intimate relationships through natural selection, that we, the people who would have painful feelings during conflict in intimate relationships had much more survival, reproductive, and happiness value in the long run, because it controlled our tremendously violent tendencies. And you read the book and you liked it.
I love it. I can't. What is it, out in December? Is that right? But I can order
yeah.
it. I think I've ordered it. Yeah, that's right.
Well, you're going to be sure you're going to get your own copy too. So you'll have two copies.
All right. That's great. Yeah, it's incredible, and I love that you put in that chapter because it is so critical. We're not even looking at this. We're immersed in this paradigm, the pharmaceutical industry, the medical community. They want us to believe that human suffering, i.e. psychiatric illness, and that's in quotations, is a result of a chemical imbalance in the brain when there's not a shred of scientific evidence to back that up. But when we start looking at things like attachment deprivation, nature deprivation, those things are rampant, and they are clearly connected. Now, when I say that, I want to make sure I preface it with this. I'm not talking about attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. That is a normal range, you know, bioevolutionary-based survival pattern. That's what that is. That's no more a psychiatric illness than the man in the moon, but running, jumping, climbing, fidgeting. But when you start talking about things like depression and panic attacks and anxiety, why are we so depressed? Why are we so anxious? No one is asking those questions. Why is this happening? And we won't look at the root causes. We won't. We want to pretend like it's biologically induced, i.e. your brain's chemically imbalanced.
It's so interesting, Jeannie. I really like the way this is going. Just last night, I was up to 2 a.m. my time, 1 a.m. the show. I'm the resident psychiatrist on George Norrie's Coast to Coast. Periodically, I go on and talk about something, sometimes for 5 minutes, sometimes for a couple hours. And last night, they asked me to come on and talk about these rage episodes on airplanes that have been happening lately, particularly about people pushing their seats back and getting bumped. And, you know, it's the epitome of everything that's wrong. You take a whole bunch of people, instead of putting them in school, you cram them into an airplane. They can't move about freely. They're not getting fed. It's just like being in school. Their amenities increasingly are being taken away from them. They get angry. They get irritable. On one of my flights, just my most recent flights, is a baby crying hysterically. And I did something I do routinely at my talks and on airplanes and wherever I am. I just got up and walked over because I know that a mother trying to handle a couple of babies, and she's got this one who's, I think she was 18 or 20 months old, lying at her feet on the floor screaming. She's got another child. She doesn't want to get too upset. And dad's across the aisle. And I just walked over and poked my head over to the top and smiled down at the baby and said, "I'm here." And in seconds, the child stopped crying. Somebody was reaching out, a new, fresh face. This is in no way negative about the mom who's in this terrible situation. You know, we lose this now. We don't have any sense of connectedness, relationship, and how much it matters. And what you're doing is so important.
I just know that we have to get to the root of the problem. We can't continue applying Band-Aid solutions to this problem. And when you talk about children, I mean, that's my heart. That's my love. That's my core. But when I think about their developing brains, they're so different than adults. And to inundate that beautiful, pure, developing brain with all these toxic chemicals that we call psychiatric medications, to me, is criminal.
Yes, it's child abuse.
Absolutely.
The perpetrators are not the parents, or rarely are the perps the parents. It's the psychopharmaceutical complex that's perpetrating this, along with the government and
you have to
big medical organizations. Yes?
And the schools. The implication the schools play in this. I believe it was Dr. Fred Bauman that published that 98% of all referrals for psychiatric diagnoses come directly from the United States public school system. And if that's not complicity, I don't know what is.
Yeah. I don't know if the percentage is quite that high anymore, because parents have been so indoctrinated, they take their kids to the pediatricians now. But studies, I mean, this whole process of diagnosing ADHD, they went through the schools. The pharmaceutical industry set up workshops, sometimes working with the Department of Education, and really convinced teachers. So they're the ones who were targeted for the propaganda. It's amazing to open our minds to what you're saying, that what children would be doing much better with is if they were with their parents and their mothers were doing constructive things like parenting and working in whatever ways were possible, but they should be with their mothers. It is radical, and I'm sure you were attacked for it, and it makes absolute sense to me.
I think we can even go farther back than being with mother. I think at the very beginning, we have to look at how we're doing birth in this country. At the turn of the century, 1900, about 98% of all of our babies were born naturally. Of course they were. They were born at home with their mothers. And now it's exactly the opposite. It's 97% of women in the United States of America have some type of pharmaceutical intervention during birth. And when you do that to any mammal, you disrupt natural processes, particularly hormone production. I mean, when mammals are giving birth, this huge flood or cocktail, if you will, of hormones is produced, and it makes that mother riveted on that child. It makes her secrete milk through the pituitary gland. And when you're disrupting this with all these pharmaceutical interventions, what are we really doing? So at the very beginning in the hospital, we're drugged. And think about this. The mother's body, probably 150 pounds, let's just say that. That's 30 to 40 times the weight of that baby. And so who's getting the majority of those drugs that are crossing the placenta? It's the baby. And then we do all kinds of crazy things, like we take the baby away from her, we put it in a nursery, we give the baby formula and sugar water. We thwart the mammalian evolutionary process right at the beginning with all the drugs and all of the crazy things we're doing in the neonatal wards. So it's an incredible journey that I've watched over the last 30 or 40 years. And then, of course, we have the lowest rates of breastfeeding, initiation and duration in the world. We have the lowest rates of co-sleeping in the world, and the highest rates of psychiatric drug use. And I am the only person writing out there that sees the correlation. To me, it's crystal clear.
Good work, JD. Good work. We're talking with Jeannie Stolzer, who's full professor of child development and lots of other things at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, spelled K-E-A-R-N-E-Y, Nebraska, where I'm going to be speaking in a couple of weeks. If you just tuned into the show, Jeannie, really quickly again, and then we'll go to break, say where I'm going to be talking and what night.
The University of Nebraska at Kearney, the Ponderosa Room. It's September 15th. That's a Monday at 7 p.m.
Thank you. Let's go to break. And I really like this conversation. I want to talk more about natural. I want you to respond to, you know, the kind of issues like, well, you know, what was a death rate of mothers like before they were giving birth in hospitals? What does that show, and so on?
Right.
Things like that. Challenging questions. We'll be back after the music. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And I'm back with, I think, one of the most interesting guests I have, and in some ways one of the most controversial, at least on for this audience, Jeannie Stultz, a professor of child and adolescent development at the University of Nebraska in Kearney. And I want to sort of raise some issues with Jeannie to talk about. First of all, what about infant mortality rates in the U.S.? Do we have any idea before and after hospitalizations? And what about maternal mortality? Was it really better was it better to be born at home for everybody?
A lot of data out there. We kept pretty compendious records. And what we know is after the advent of hospital birth, when that becomes the mainstay, we actually see infant and maternal death rates increasing. And I always say this to my students in infant development. I say, you guys, if I have $1 million check right here, it's filled out, it's good, and one of you is going to get this $1 million and you're going to go to where the sickest of the sick are, the most contagious people in this city. Where are you going? And every one of them say they're going to the hospital. And that's why infant and maternal death rates rose, because that is where the sickest of the sick are. That's where MRSA is. It's where AIDS is. And babies, you have to remember, all mammal babies are born with a really immature immune system. So if they're born in their home and they're breastfed immediately, the mother already has antibodies to her home. It's her environment. So she, in turn, gives those immunities to her child, and they're safe. But that mother doesn't have any immunity to AIDS or to MRSA, so, or staph or strep. So the child picks that up, and with their immature immune system, that's why our rates went higher. Most people don't know that. Now, of course, there was a time in human history when child mortality rates and infant and maternal mortality rates were quite high, because we didn't understand with home birthing that germs were alive and they were carried on hands. So there was a lot of infection. But after we understood that germs were alive, we really, really decreased infant mortality. And I think you should look at the Norway studies that are out. Developmentalists like me like Norway, because they have the lowest rates of infant and maternal mortality rates in the world, and about 86% of their babies are born at home. They also have much different nursing rates than we do. They breastfeed, I think it's 96% are breastfed at birth, and then by age two, it's about 80%. So completely different than the United States.
What are the rates in the U.S. for breastfeeding now?
We're at about 40%, but researchers like me, you know, the question that you just asked drives us crazy, because any breastfeeding is considered breastfeeding. So if you nursed one time on one side, that child is considered breastfed. And we can't have that anymore, because we know that the breastfeeding is a continuous variable. And what that means is the longer that it's engaged in, the more health benefits for mother and baby. We can't just, you know, say, okay, it is an either-or variable. It doesn't work like that.
In my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, coming out in December, available now. It's the first show I pushed it on, I think. Available now on Amazon. I used some of the research you sent me. I cited some of it about how the emotional and psychological states and physical of the child, but also the emotional states of the parents, are improved when the child nurses.
Oh my God, there's such powerful hormones that are secreted in the maternal bloodstream, the most important being oxytocin and prolactin. And how much of that we actually secrete is based on duration, frequency, and intensity of nursing. And really, in the actual medical literature, these are called the love hormones, oxytocin and prolactin, because they induce states of bliss and joy and wanting to remain in close physical proximity with that young child. And when we don't have that, it has the potential to impact maternal behavior patterns. And I am in no way suggesting that all maternal behavior patterns are entirely hormonally regulated. What I am stating as a scientific fact is that hormones do play a role in maternal behaviors.
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
We know they said
we're mammals, as you said.
We're absolutely mammals.
We can fight the hormones. We can go along with them. We can fight them. We can modify and how we conduct ourselves. But we are working with mammalian bodies.
I think I was in New York City, and I was presenting a paper, Mammalian versus Reptilian Mothering. And that time, I thought I was actually going to be mobbed after, not in a good way, after the presentation, because I was showing how we're moving as human mammals towards more reptilian mothering. And oh my God, that did not go down well. But if you really stop and think about it, what do mammals do? They give live birth. They're not drugged when they give birth. They breastfeed immediately, and they breastfeed long-term, depending on their lifespan. They co-sleep, and they remain in close physical proximity to their young during the formative years. Why? For protection. And it doesn't have anything to do with dependency. That's a whole different pathological issue. The mother lion is watching her cubs. Of course she's letting them climb and jump and chase bunnies. But she's there. She's watching. And she's not thwarting normal developmental processes. She's encouraging them. But if a predator should come, she's right there. And that is especially important during the night, because that's when most predators, including human predators, prowl.
Wow. What about the issue of the attachment theory encouraging lengthy nursing into, I don't know, what, 4, 5, 6 years old? And what happens to the child in our culture? Does that end up hurting the child? Is it sometimes more the mother's dependency than the child's needs? I'd like you to just address that.
Of course you can have emotionally unstable mothers. You really can. And their mothering comes, is driven, if you will, by this sort of insatiable need to be loved and wanted. That's not the typical mother. At least I hope it's not.
No, wait a minute. That's me, too. That's just how we handle it, Jeannie.
Yes.
I have an insatiable need to be loved.
Oh, I do, too. I do, too. But what I'm trying to say is there's
I understand what you're saying. Go ahead.
Huge difference between attachment mothering and dependency mothering. I call it neurotic mothering, actually, in papers I've published. Neurotic mothering thwarts normal developmental processes. It's driven by fear. So you don't want the child out of your sight. You don't, you can't let them climb the tree. They might break their neck. That's fear-driven, neurotic-driven mothering. And so if you're doing that for that reason, you really have to question what you're doing. But it should be focused on the needs of the child. And this sort of primordial mother-child dyad has been here for so long. And they're dependent on each other for optimal psychological and physiological processing. You know, I'm so glad to be alive at this time, because the first research is coming out now about what breastfeeding really does for moms. Because we've been looking a lot at the children and what it does for them. And we know the longer you're nursed, you know, the more powerful your immune system is, so the healthier you are through the life course, blah, blah, blah. But maternal effects, it's absolutely incredible. Lowered anxiety, depression, bipolar, lower osteoporosis, type 1 and type 2 diabetes, stroke, heart attack, blood pressure. I mean, it's unbelievable. So it's sort of this physiological interdependence that we're both dependent on each other for optimal emotional and physiological processing. But see, we're in trouble in this country because, and I know this is very politically incorrect, but I'm saying it anyway, we've constructed a society that values the worker over the mother. Watch women when they're in a group together. They say to each other things like this: what do you do? And when I say, I'm a professor, you're kidding me, tell me about it. But for many years, and I still do it sometimes, I say, I'm a mother. They look at me up and down like, oh my God, you know, the shrimp's over in the corner, go get it. So we're in this place that we really value the worker. over the mother, and we've never been in that place before. And we're suffering for it.
I'm silent because I'm sort of just letting it sink in. I think what everything you're saying today is so, so important. All right, well, confronting difficult issues again. If you have 100 mothers in America who are doing attachment parenting, what's going to be the range of how long they nurse? Or according to what you're saying, the child wants to nurse.
Well, let's look at worldwide rates. Right now, the average age of weaning in the world is 3.2 years. Now, the United States is in that.
That sounds so impossible to me as an American.
Of course it does, because you're enculturated here, and you see the weaning occurring at 6 weeks and the pacifiers and all that stuff and the formula. So it does look upside down to us, but in reality, it's us who are the outliers. It's us who are the outliers, but it has to do with our policies, too. We are the only country on planet Earth that does not provide women with paid maternity leave. So of course, a Swedish woman can nurse for 2 years. Her government is making it possible. And how are they doing this? They're saving billions, and yes, I said billions of dollars a year in health care costs. According to our Surgeon General, if Americans would nurse exclusively for 6 months, we would save $3.5 billion a year in health care costs. If we'd nurse exclusively for 1 year, just 1 year, we'd save $7 billion a year in health care costs. But we won't do it. We simply won't do it.
So interesting. Well, you know, I'm a small government person, but you're making a really, really good argument for a social good here, a very, very strong argument. Why do you think that we're more loath to do that? We're doing a bunch of other things. Do you think it's just in general that other countries are providing more social services?
I don't think it's social services. I think that all countries, and this is pretty cynical on my part, but I think that all countries see the dollar as the bottom line, and they know that by encouraging attachment parenting, long-term nursing, you know, raising your children, they're saving money, and they're saving big money, not only in health care costs, but in psychiatric costs, in penal complexes. They're saving money. They're not doing this out of the goodness of their heart. I mean, in places like Norway and Sweden, it's been going on 80, 90 years. This is means tested. They're not doing it because they're awful kind and wonderful Scandinavian folks. They're doing it because it saves big money.
We need bumper stickers, nurse, don't drug.
Nurse, don't drug. And I really do believe this, too. I think I was the first person to publish this about how psychiatric drugging of children is related to breastfeeding, you know, attachment parenting. And I really do believe this. I believe when you have that primordial connection to your young, you're not going to allow an outsider, i.e. a teacher, a psychologist, a psychiatrist, blah, 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 to tell you anything about your child, because you know that you know that child 1,000 times better than they are. And that doesn't mean if the child is suffering that you won't get them help. Because a lot of times human beings, adults and children, need outside help. They need caring, empathetic, compassionate people to give them the tools to feel better, to do better, but not drugs. When did we get like this?
Jeannie, are you allowing any time when I'm there for you and I to talk to students? I guess I'm going to come to some of your classes, aren't I?
Yes.
So this is going to be a lot of fun. I think we should do it, like, jointly and have this kind of conversation. And I can even raise these issues. Let me go back to another tough issue. I actually learn from you and hear new things and new information at a greatly accelerated rate. What about the issue of the suffering of labor. Now, I mean, the first thing that occurs to me is, of course, you could just as well give narcotics or whatever else you were going to give at home. They're not that dangerous in lower doses. But what about the idea of the suffering? Because, you know, a lot of you hear stories about women who want to do natural delivery and they want to do it with a midwife and they do it in some sort of protected setting, but it's, you know, it's in a hospital-like setting of sorts. And then when the pain starts, they, you know, they beg for an anesthetic. What about that? Address that.
We do so many things to women that we would never think of doing to a dog or a cat or a lion. For example, we lay her in a supine position, meaning on her back, with her legs up in the air in stirrups, so her tailbone is blocking the birth canal, and we tell her, push, move towards gravity, go against the laws of nature. No mammal can birth with the vagina toward the ceiling.
Oh, gosh.
Mammals birth pushing down, bearing down. But hospitals won't allow this, so of course the pain is intense. But most importantly, all mammals secrete a natural opioid during birth. It's natural. It's a natural opioid. It's when you cross your own pain threshold, your body starts secreting this, and it takes some of that pain away. Will I ever say that natural childbirth is without pain? Of course not. Of course not. There's pain. Just like if you've ever watched a mother cat give birth, there's pain involved. There is. But then, amazingly, the second she starts nursing, she starts secreting other nanopeptide hormones that significantly decrease that pain.
Amazing. I've actually never had such long pauses before on my show. It's really so interesting to hear you talk. What do we know about parent-child relationships prehistoric? I mean, most of our knowledge is going to be from looking at, tribal life in the last 150 years or 200 years that it's been documented. What do we know about it? I mean, it pretty much, isn't it, that the children were raised mostly probably in huts, in small villages with a very intense relationship going on, sleeping with mom and dad in a mostly monogamous situation?
Interestingly, we have a lot of anthropological data on this subject, and I can't believe I've lived long enough to see this data come out. We can actually look, if we have enough bone marrow, we can look to our ancient ancestors, and I think the oldest one we have right now is 5,200 years, but we know exactly how long they received human milk. Can you believe we can do that? We can do it. And we can also tell you when other foods besides human milk were introduced. So on average, your ancient ancestors, and most of this data is coming out of ancient Mesopotamia, around Syria, Jordan, Iraq, those regions.
So this is during civilization, you're saying 5,000 years ago?
Approximately 5,000 years ago.
Yeah. Okay, we already had cities by then. Go ahead.
Absolutely, but these are the oldest skeletal remains that we can get the marrow out of, so we can tell you with scientific accuracy how long these children were breastfed. And on average, they were breastfed between 4 and 6 years. And it makes perfect sense if you think about our ancient ancestors, because to chew the foods that were readily available, nuts, berries, you know, meats, you have to have molars, you know, those back molars, and those don't come in until 5 to 7 years. The other thing that's really critically important about this is that the human immune system is not fully functional till about 5 to 7 years. So when mother's nursing, she's giving all the antibodies. She's pumping that immune system, you know, making that little immature immune system strong. And then it will become strong on its own at around 4 or 5, you know, somewhere around there.
Do you think there's a correlation between something like these seemingly skyrocketing rates of asthma and the decline of nursing?
It's absolutely, unequivocally a fact. We know for positive that the lower rates of breastfeeding increase asthma in children, and we're seeing it exponentially across America. There are places where asthma, allergies, those kind of things, they don't exist. For example, in the Kung tribe in Africa, we just don't see it. As a matter of fact, we see less than 2% rates of breast cancer there, too, but we don't want to talk about that. I just saw an expert on breast cancer telling, you know, how important diet was and exercise, and they are. They're critical. But tell the most significant, statistically significant contributor to breast cancer, and that's low rates of breastfeeding. But she didn't mention it because it's politically incorrect, and I know she doesn't want to be stomped. But it's just scientific evidence. That's what it is.
Well, we've got 5 or 6 minutes left. Would you talk a little bit about yourself, when you started coming to these conclusions, how you've managed to become a full professor? How long have you been a tenured professor?
Tenured professor about 7 years, 6 years.
Talk a little bit about yourself in that regard.
Well, I've always loved children. If you see pictures of me when I'm 4 and 5 and 6 years old, I have a baby on my hip. I always loved them. They were my...
Were you breastfed?
No, I was not. And my mother is still alive, and she's 87 years old, and I still do not have the heart to tell her that what the doctor in Schuyler, Nebraska, told her was not accurate. And that was, they told my mother with her first little baby that she had poison milk. That's fact.
Oh, Lord.
And so 7 of her babies, including me, never got a drop of their mother's milk. And there's my 87-year-old mother still telling people her milk was poison. Mm-hmm. That's fact.
That's heartbreaking.
It's heartbreaking. It's heartbreaking. And what makes me, I think one of the things that drives me with the breastfeeding attachment paradigm is that we know that physicians who are supposed to be the experts, i.e. the pediatrician, the family practitioner, the OBGYN, they receive no training in human lactation. So here's all these women who've lost their role models. They don't know, you know, their mother didn't nurse, their sister didn't nurse, like me. So you go to the doctor, and then you figure out they don't have any training. It's sort of like you coming to me about rocket science. Sorry, I don't have any training in that area. So you asked me about myself, and so I loved kids, animals, my whole life, and was a Montessori teacher for many, many years, and I watched, this is 1982, 83, none of my kids, never even heard of ADHD, depression, anxiety, none of them. And then about 4 years later, all of this starts. And I watch this, and I think this is what really drove me, is watching what changes were occurring with the way we were treating our children. And so that's my story in a nutshell.
When did you start to get interested in attachment theory?
Oh, I didn't even know there was a name for it. Like I said, I'm an animal avid animal lover, and I've always taken great lessons from them, and I've always watched them. And oh, I have to tell you this, I had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Jane Goodall, and we were having the most fabulous conversation, and I said to her, do you remember who your first sort of guru was with regard to children? Because she has a son. And she said, yeah, it was Flo. And she started telling me about watching her. You know, she was an aristocrat from England, you know? You put him in boarding school at 8.
Flo for everybody is a great matriarch of the chimpanzees of Gombe.
Yes. And she watched this mother. She watched her birth. She watched her, you know, carry this baby on her. She watched her nurse. She watched the whole thing. And then she watched her babies grow into these self-sufficient leaders of their groups. And really, you know, I think one of the things, and we don't like to talk about this, when we talk about co-sleeping and breastfeeding, we automatically think, oh, my God, you're going to make this spoiled, clingy mama's boy. Who wants that? Of course no one wants that. But when you look at the mammalian kingdom as a whole, the mother lion who's nursing right now in the Serengeti and co-sleeping, she's raising the king of the jungle. But she knows now in this particular particular developmental space, that he's a baby and he needs her. He won't always, but she's going to do her best to give him the strongest, most secure foundation so he can be the king of the jungle, so he's not ridden with anxiety and depression and weakness of all sorts. That's her job.
You've convinced me a lot. I'm going to really enjoy the continuing conversations. I can't wait to just hang out with you.
I can't either. Speak. I can't believe you're really coming to the University of Nebraska.
Tell people again when I'm going to be there.
September 15th, 7 p.m., University of Nebraska, Kearney, Student Union, Ponderosa Room. I can't believe it.
Thank you so much for being on my radio show. Jeannie Stolzer, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R, Stolzer, Professor of Child and Adolescent Development, University of Nebraska, Kearney. Thank you so much for being on my show and being my friend.
Thank you so much.